Good afternoon and welcome from the Krannert Art Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois, our first program in the Second Sunday series. And it features the Illinois Brass Quintet. And we'll begin our program in just a moment. Welcome, everybody. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, experienced full-time professional agents listing and selling homes in Champaign County. RE/MAX above the crowd, 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting, in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos, and in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Before we begin this afternoon, this is actually the first of a few questions I want to ask you. A lot of people get used to crossword puzzles on Sunday morning and to get you all geared for what? Later in the day. So we don't want to waste all that energy. The first question I have, name the oldest faculty brass quintet in existence at any music school in the world. The oldest. It's a trick question. It's the Illinois Brass Quintet, which we're going to hear today. They were founded back in 1955, so they've got a big anniversary coming up next year. And we're excited to have them with us this afternoon for this program. Did you get that right? I'll give you a chance for a couple more later on. The quintet features trumpets Michael Ewald and Ronald Rahm. Kazimierz Machal is featured on the horn, Elliot Chazanoff on the trombone, and Mark Moore on the tuba. They'll be joined by a very special guest on the second half of the program. Stay tuned for that. But let's bring them out here already, the Illinois Brass Quintet.
Thank you. Wilkie Renwick, the composer of the piece we just played, was a hornist, was a member of the Denver Symphony, which preceded the Colorado Symphony. I guess he was a graduate of the New England Conservatory, and he was the music librarian of the Denver Symphony, as well as a composer and arranger. That piece was entitled Dances, probably you've seen in your program, and it's a little bit lopsided. We're moving now to Gregor Eichinger. Gregor Eichinger is a name that may be familiar. He was part of the German Renaissance period that just branched slightly into the Baroque. He was a student of the music of Giovanni Gabrieli, and he made a trip to Rome to study this music. And he spent his life writing sacred music. We share with you now a piece, a Jubilate Deo.
Thank you. Thank you. This next work comes from a very famous collection by Johann Sebastian Bach entitled The Art of the Fugue. This piece, or this work, was written towards the end of his life. Now, when I was a student at school, they told us that Bach was lying on his deathbed, blind, dictating this work to his servant. Evidently, that's not true. Latest research shows that he had written this towards the end of his life and just stopped working on the piece. So it's a collection of 14 fugues. The last one is unfinished, and 5 canons. They're all held together by a sort of theme or subject, if you're talking fugal procedure, and it sounds like this. So that's the idea or the superglue that holds all of these 14 fugues and 5 canons together. Now, we're going to play number 4 for you today. So, if you know anything about Bach, you know that the subject's not going to sound like that at all. He's going to do something with it. In this case, he's going to turn it upside down. Also, very interesting, too, at the end of the piece, in the last couple of measures, Bach signs his name. B for B flat, A, C, H, B natural. And you'll hear that in the horn. This is the first fugue where Bach does that. Later in the 14th fugue, that was going to be one of the fugue subjects. So here's contrapuntus number 4 from The Art of the Fugue. Thank you.
3 years ago yesterday, the United States of America sustained its probably greatest tragedy. When programming this concert, we decided we wanted to commemorate that event, honor the heroes, and remember the victims. The work we're going to play for you in their honor is a work written by John Stevens, who's the tuba teacher at University of Wisconsin-Madison and a wonderful composer. He received his training at the Eastman School of Music and at Yale University. The work is entitled Seasons, and the movement we're going to play for you is Autumn. The character of the movement is introspective and slightly somber, but hopeful. And we perform this in memory of the victims and in honor of the heroes.
Thank you.
first met Luther Henderson in the early 1980s. At the time, I was a member of a group called the Canadian Brass, and Luther was writing, had just finished doing the cast recording for Ain't Misbehavin' on Broadway. And our record producer at the time was Tom Shepard, and he asked if we would be interested in having Luther Henderson write some charts for us to do a mostly Fats Waller album. And of course, the answer had to be yes. I mean, why would you say no? So we met Luther Henderson. He came to the studio and brought, I think it was five lovely gems of music. He had never written for brass quintet before. He had written for virtually every other kind of an ensemble, but he had never written for brass quintet before. And we're going to share with you, to close this half of our concert, a set of three of these wonderful gems from the Ain't Misbehavin' show. The first is Looking Good and Feeling Bad. And this is going to start with a little mini cadenza by Kaz on the horn. Of course, Kaz is looking good. You can see that. Of course, horn players tend to feel bad because all of their music always goes out the backside. So looking good and feeling bad. In the middle of the set is Loungin' at the Waldorf. Loungin' describes a situation where if you're, you know, a little bit hard times have set in, and you get dressed up in your best duds and you go down to the best hotel in town and you check out the parties and kind of sneak in and join a party, have a drink and talk with the people and grab some food and, you know, be really cool and kind of don't be too you know, out in front about it. And then kind of as the evening grows to a close, you find a nice comfortable couch in the lobby and have a night's sleep. Loungin' at the Waldorf. And to close our set, Handful of Keys. This Handful of Keys features Michael Ewald's hand on his piccolo trumpet. And a piccolo trumpet is a very, very dangerous instrument to play. I mean, it's very small, and a lot of pressure builds up inside your head. And it's quite possible that he could blow the hair right out of the top of his head. Now, I know this because I used to play this solo. Thank you.
Thank you.
there they are, the Illinois Brass Quintet. We'll hear more from them on the second half of the program, concluding near the first half with a Fats Waller suite arranged by Luther Henderson. You're listening to the second Sunday concert of WILL-FM. Let me mention something briefly before our intermission interview about the members of the quintet. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, in 1955, the quintet founded, and the oldest faculty brass quintet at any music school in the world. They concertize throughout the area, and an important part of what they do is educational outreach. And in that capacity, they perform clinics in elementary and secondary schools throughout the Midwest. Michael Ewald is the trumpeter. He's also the principal trumpet of the Sinfonia da Camera, the Champaign-Urbana Symphony, and previously a principal trumpet for 8 years with the Illinois Symphony Orchestra. Professor Ronald Rahm, the other trumpet player, who for many years performed in the Los Angeles area with a number of ensembles in the New York City area, including Broadway, probably best remembered for the years 1971 through 2000 when he was a member of the famous Canadian Brass. The hornist in the group is Kazimierz Machala, who was born in Poland. He's no stranger to our program. He appeared with his entire family in one of our second Sunday concerts previously. Our trombonist is Elliot Chasanoff, who began actually as a cellist when he first started out, and among the credits, the ensembles he played with, the United States Air Force Band and Orchestra. And our tubist is Mark Moore, who is also a member of Medicare 789 and the Sonus Brass, one of the founding members. So those are our members of the Illinois Brass Quintet. Earlier this week, WILL's Kevin Kelly had the chance to speak with trumpeter Ronald Rahm, and he talked about the days of the Canadian Brass, specifically asking Ronald Rahm whether back in those days each of the members brought their own sense of humor or whether the humor sort of evolved from the group.
I think the answer is yes. Each of us had our sense of humor intact, and we were very always willing to poke fun at ourselves and each other and take a jab as well as give a jab. And I think the one thing that one has to remember about Canadian Brass in particular, and I think musicians in general, is that if we are really us, there is a very serious component when it comes to playing the music. But there's a very humorous component because, we find humor in all kinds of other things because it's very ironic. As a professional musician, we spend hours and hours and hours kind of trapped in a silent environment except for the sound of our own voice or our own instrument, and it tends to drive us a little bit crazy, you know. And we crave contact with others. We find the humor in pretty much everything. And, of course, as a brass player, now you also know this from being a brass player, you know that our sense of humor is a little bit bizarre. And so the idea of bringing that as a point of reality to the masses and mass audience was very attractive to us at Canadian Brass. And, of course, it's still very attractive to me, and we see that now in the Illinois Brass Quintet, which I think is chomping at the bit to have a good time all the time anyway. And I think it's really a positive, powerful concept.
There was a guy who will remain nameless for obvious reasons in a moment, back when I was at Northwestern, who used to have a brass ensemble there. And I remember that he specifically commented in an interview with me. I was interviewing him for something. I forget if it was radio or what. That they took themselves very seriously and they didn't need to do any of this falling down and stuff. And he said some other things. It was clearly a reference to the Canadian Brass.
Okay.
Which he, you know, obviously didn't mean necessarily as a compliment. But obviously, you think that's a very important part of performing. I mean, I don't have any idea if you guys would fall down in performance.
Well, we never, ever minimize the musical value. Never. The masterful part, if there is a masterful part of Canadian Brass, is that we were able to include our sense of humor through the introductions, through the fact that we commissioned literally hundreds of works, some of which were stage pieces. And, of course, stage works, all of a sudden, you're not just blowing a horn. You've got to be a stage participant. You have to be part of the action. And if that means that, you know, I remember having a musical shootout with Jack Sheldon on stage in for a television broadcast. Is that bad? Well, no, I don't think so. And he shot me dead. He says, I knew you shouldn't have used that mouthpiece. And he shot me dead with his trumpet. And of course, I had to fall down, and that was it. It was a Western bit, you know.
Yeah.
And so to poke fun, sure, great, we, you know, good. But to diminish the music, never. Never, ever. So we always played the best music we could play and played it the best we could play it. And I think when people would take shots, pot shots at us, and that happened quite often, especially at the beginning, it was because people were shy about or insecure about their own credibility. You know, there's notoriously brass concerts can be deadly boring. And we vowed as a group, Canadian Brass vowed, and we've done the same with Illinois Brass Quintet. We vowed as a group that we would never put on a boring show, never. And if it meant sitting in your chair and having 30 seconds or 60 seconds of silence while you're blowing the water out of your instrument to try and get your blood back in your lips, that was too long a period of time. That's just not right. And to subject an audience that has been weaned on television and action that takes less than 60 seconds to have a shot each time. I mean, our attention span, of course, has changed as a mass audience, and I don't talk about our high intelligentsia here in the university environment, because that's a different ball game. But I'm talking about the mass attraction for television, and that it's a requirement to have something happen every 60 seconds or less, and we're weaned on that. And of course, when you're putting on a concert. And a concert where people are paying money to attend, they have a choice very often of going to your concert or going to a football game or going to a basketball game or going to 6 play events. You know, if you're in New York City, there are 15 Broadway shows running and 100 off-Broadway shows. And they could go to dinner theater. They could go to almost anything else, not to mention the movies. So what you're doing in your concert has to compete on some level. And I'm not suggesting we should be doing tomfoolery to compete, but we certainly should be exploring all possible avenues of the music industry in terms of attraction, because that's where we need to go. We need to continue to have our art grow, and in order to have our art grow, we have to have it marketable.
Now, you have had a lot of personal experience. You mentioned New York and all the things that one can do there, and you were in New York and did an awful lot of things there.
Yes.
In all kinds of musical genres. And from what I've read about your own teaching philosophy and what you alluded to earlier, you've brought some of that experience here and into your philosophy. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think the most important thing for me is to empower the students. We all have dreams. We all have things we want to do. And even though we may not be able to fulfill those dreams specifically to the level that we may dream them, we have to be empowered to follow those dreams, because they will lead us to other dreams, and they will lead us to other routes, and they will lead us to all kinds of successes. And the only way to fail at anything in life is to quit. And if we kind of stick in there and hang in there long enough with enough positive energy, we're going to succeed. The other thing we want to do in the studio is to tell our students how great they are. We want them to remind themselves that they are great, that they are brilliant, that they're there because they've arrived at a university environment because of their ability to succeed. And that gets beaten out of us all too often. So I remember, you know, I along the way, with all my experiences, I've thought for many, many hours about how we transition from childhood into adulthood and into our professional lives, no matter what course that takes. And I think, you know, when we're really little young children, our parents and our, you know, and our grandparents and our uncles and aunts, they hug us, they tell us they love us, they tell us how great they are, how great we are, and how proud they are of us. And of course, the minute we start to socialize, when we're about 6 or 7 years old, you know, we start to have friends and we start to play games, and those games, you know, if you throw the ball really well, you're usually chosen to play on the team quite early. And of course, if you don't throw the ball very well, you're chosen towards the end of the list, and you may be, if you're the weakest with throwing the ball, you're the last one to be chosen. Well, you know, you start to feel badly about things. You say, well, gee, I don't throw the ball very well. And then a little later on, you're in class and you're in your math class, and one of your colleagues says to you, well, how'd you do on your math test? Well, I got a 78. Oh, gee, I got a 96. You must not be very good at math. Gee, I must not bear it. And how are you going to be at anything if you tell yourself you're not good at it? So the research tells us that what we put in our subconscious mind is what and who we are. So if we put positive things, greatness, if we put fantastic achievements in our subconscious mind by telling ourselves how great we are, by reinforcing each other of how great we are, by complimenting each other and saying, this is terrific, and you do this beautifully, and focusing on the beautiful things, the things that are not as strong as that will grow to be as strong. But if we focus on the things that are wrong, everything is brought down to that level. So in our studio, and in the brass studio at the University of Illinois, we've taken over that particular philosophy very strongly. We help each other. We encourage each other. We empower the students to succeed.
Is there some way that you bring in some of your own experience in different styles of music? You've done sort of, run the gamut of the classical realm, whether it's opera and orchestral and ballet and chamber music, but you've also been involved with some jazz musicians and all kinds of things like that. How do you bring that into what normally is considered to be a classical school of music?
Well, I think it's very simple for me, because anything that the students bring in to play, we can, you know, we'll do it. We also include chamber music emphasis, which is going to have, we encourage the jazz-oriented players to write for each other and to participate and play. We encourage them to go and play in the jazz band. Everyone's, you know, I just sent a broadcast out to the whole trumpet studio that Chip McNeil's around. You guys got to sign up and play in the jazz band. So you got a group of extra trumpet players there. and when the students bring in their different styles, we play through the styles. Music is music is music.
As obvious as that may seem, there are a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily agree with that. There's good music, and then there's, you know, all that other stuff.
Well, I have challenges too. I mean, there are my challenge was, for example, hip hop. I like a lot. Rap is a little tougher for me, only because it's very negative. Talks a lot with violence, deals with beating and killing and violent endeavor, and the constant pounding is set up at a heart pulse rate slightly faster than we would like to be comfortable at, and so it excites us in a way that could be construed as a negative influence. So my challenge with rap is to get through and get the environment going and figure out where. You know, what they're saying, so that I can respond in kind as a musician. Because I think that musicians have a responsibility. We are in a unique position where, since music is felt so strongly, a painting or a sculpture, once it's completed, it's pretty well complete. But music is constantly changing. Music performance is always changing. And you know this from all of your performing. You know that music is never static, and in that change, we have the ability to envelop the audience and create good feeling, and we have the responsibility to do that as well, to try and kind of take some of the edge off of our societal challenges.